Hello, I'm Floyd Maxwell, justthinkit.com, bringing you a Floydcast number 32 for September 22nd, 2014. Well, 32, 3 and 2 is 5, right? Time for a 5-ish cast. Well, speaking of someone who's 5-ish, Ray Rice. Rice is 5'3'8". We've talked about Ray Rice in the past. This is the football player that knocked out his girlfriend in an elevator, punched her and knocked her out, and then the first video that we all saw was just him dragging her unconscious out of the elevator. And this has gone on to become a massive story. The media really likes these massive stories. Yeah, they want something meaty. It's like a giant pack of jackals. They don't just want a fallen antelope. They want a whole herd of antelopes, or they want an elephant to chew on. So, you know, things sort of came to a head there, I don't know, last week, something like that, where they released the inside the elevator video. Prior to that time, we had all speculated. We'd sort of wondered, you know, some of the media people had wondered, why didn't we see the inside? And surely the head of the NFL had enough power and authority to see the inside video. So we're going to sort of get to the bottom of that a little bit. I was reading a story on ESPN called Rice Case, Purposeful Misdirection by Team, Scant Investigation by NFL. This all happened at the Revel Atlantic City. This is a casino that promptly went out of business, which is somewhat interesting itself. Well, let's look at some of the numbers of the Revel. Well, Revel, or, yeah, Revel. 178, the same combination as Ray. Atlantic, 268. City, 933. When you add it all together, 371 total, one destiny. I've talked about the 371 at least once before, where I mentioned that it's a very argumentative combination. And of course, the one and one destiny is a very physical quality. Something physically happens, and there's a physical force to that one that is unmistakable. Well, this casino had that for destiny. And by the way, I've also talked about the one destiny where you can't save any money. It doesn't matter how much you're making, you can't save money. Well, how classic that a casino goes out of business. That's like a bank going out of business, right? You know, the bankers make the rules. If they go out of business, that's some pretty serious mismanagement. But the Revel Atlantic City has one destiny. And if anyone is likely to go out of business, it's going to be Revel. The address of the casino was 500 Broadway. Well, 500, the street address, reduces to a 5. More violence there, right? And more chaos. Here's a quote from the story. The couple, they were engaged. They had dinner and wine, then went to the casino's main bar, called The Social, where they split at least one bottle of Patron Tequila, Ray's Rice's favorite liquor. So you're drinking wine at a meal. Probably at the end of the meal, you'd be sufficiently drunk that you shouldn't drive. According to my toxic document, you know, the maximum you should consume at any time of alcohol is about half a drink. Let's say at dinner they had 2 or 3 drinks. They're already drunk. They're already legally drunk or inebriated. Story continues, by 2 a.m., Ray and Janae were intoxicated. Well, they were intoxicated before 2 a.m. By 2 a.m., they were hammered. They were probably at the point where they could barely walk. That's what I would guess. And also, they did show early footage where there's obviously some disagreeable stuff happening even before they get in the elevator, where they're sort of, you know, it's kind of like, hey, come on, the elevator's here. Only when they say, hey, come on, they're like hitting each other to like tell the other person the elevator's there. These people were severely intoxicated. So they were intoxicated and heatedly arguing as he followed her into a hotel elevator. Well, they were together. It's not like one guy snuck up and ambushed the other in the elevator. They were traveling together. That was very evident. They just weren't happy. Well, you know, alcohol is a depressant. You're not going to be happy on alcohol. There are no exceptions. The one thing about alcohol that they've studied and found is when you have that first drink, about that much, the total effect of alcohol, there's two offsetting effects. The one is that it relaxes you, and the other is that it depresses you. Well, being slightly relaxed is a pleasant feeling, and being depressed is not. And they found that when you have that first drink, roughly, depend on body size and other things, I'm sure, that the net effect is that you feel slightly better than when you started. So if you're lucky, you might get a slightly good experience of alcohol if you stop really quickly. But other than that, it's all bad. It's all downhill. That's the story of booze. But of course, you know, sports is sponsored by booze companies, right? So they're not going to go out of their way to make that point really obvious and firmly and repeatedly in the Ray Rice scandal, are they? They're not going to say, this is a story about booze and what booze does. They should, but they're not going to do that, no way. Because we're supposed to drink responsibly. We're supposed to get hammered responsibly. We're supposed to get intoxicated, i.e. poisoned, responsibly. And when we start to lose our balance and we can barely walk and we're super depressed because we're drunk, we're supposed to do all of that responsibly. Don't you know? It's interesting that there have been a number of Raven scandals over the years. The most famous one, I even mentioned it briefly, was another Ray on the same team. Another famous Ray. I mean, Ray Rice is the current famous Raven, and Ray Lewis was very much the famous Raven, Baltimore Raven. And he got involved in something and became a suspect in a double murder. And at the time, all I remember, you know, I wasn't researching things. This was like, I think it was like 10 years ago, give or take. All I remember was things seemed kind of unseemly. Things seemed like he was at least partially involved in this whole thing, not necessarily doing it, but certainly maybe his friends or the people he was hanging out with were doing something very bad. And that was all sort of blown over. Well, just recently there's been Jamal Lewis, another Lewis. These people, all of them have similar names, by the way, mathematically similar. Jamal Lewis was cocaine trafficking. Now, you know, trafficking sounds really bad. It used to sound really bad. But when you think about it, these are football players who have millions of dollars. If they use cocaine, and probably some horrific percentage of them do, they don't use it at the same level that Joe Average uses it at, right? Joe Average might, you know, have a small amount, get a little buzz once a week. These guys, they live with a tin of it on the table, right? They probably go through 10 times as much of it on average, maybe 100 times as much. So the idea of trafficking, well, the trafficking is sort of based on, well, it's a little bit more than you needed yourself. So again, a little bit more than you needed yourself for Joe Average is really just the right amount for these rich people. So the trafficking part of that is a bad label, I think. And let's just say Jamal Lewis was using cocaine. He's not the only one, but what's interesting, of course, is the name. Lewis, just like Ray Lewis. Then there was Ja Reed, and I think that's how you pronounce the first name, J-A-H, Reed, 2 counts of battery. Well, let's have a go at analyzing all of these people on this team. All of these people are sort of in the news. Every one of them has the 1 and the 5 quality. Lewis is 5'9"5". So there's a Ray Lewis in these sampling of stories. There's 4 stories. So of these 4 stories, 2 of the people had Lewis, a 5'9"5", in their makeup, in their name. Well, that means they are intensely five-ish. You could not mistake their five-ishness if you were around them for more than 30 seconds. It would be difficult to be around them more than that. It's such an intense combination, you would feel uncomfortable around them. Imagine saddling someone with a 5'9"5" name. You know, we do all of this out of ignorance because most people don't know what the name. But you know, there are people that do know. The people in power know about the importance of a name. And they are sadists. They are torturers of humanity, without a doubt. So now we're looking also for the 1 quality. Jamal, 281. Ray Lewis, 178. Ray Rice, 178 in Ray. And then this Ja Reed character, Ja 191, and then Reed 549. This Ja Reed, with his 2 counts of battery, you look at his name and I would immediately say guilty. I'm saying that slightly in jest, or, you know, I'm exaggerating, but mathematically there's no doubt whatsoever that this guy, being a football player, the names that he's got, the qualities that he's got, he would be a violent, intense person normally. This guy isn't going home and picking up a paintbrush and painting watercolors on the side. He's not doing that, not with that name. Yeah, changing the name, and it would change the person, absolutely. Of course, he's born jaw read, so regardless of what you do, you're still working with an underlying influence that's, you know, these same qualities. But, you know, it's the old story when they have twins and they separate the twins and they get different names. Well, they're different people. Or if they are given similar names and then they separate them, which happens more commonly, and then they're like at two parts of the country, but they have very similar names, like Jim and John Jones, you know, type thing, and they get separated. There have been cases where they married the same kind of girl, and they had the same kind of job, and everything. They each had a heart attack at the same age, and, you know, the similarities that happen are astounding. And we've always put that down to, well, they're twins, right? But, of course, it's, you know, it happens when they're not twins, not biological twins. But, you know, biology only takes you so far, and it's not just biology. So in my notes here, I say the most interesting thing about this massive media frenzy regarding Ray Race is how no one ever emphasizes that Ray and his fiancée were extremely intoxicated. And I've already, you know, said one of the reasons why is that, you know, the league is sponsored by alcohol companies. I mean, booze is a big part of sponsorship on TV. There was a time when, you know, they didn't want booze ads, at least maybe in Canada. I don't know if it was true in the States, but it's still kind of shocking to see booze ads. Why on earth are we advertising the most toxic thing that we ever drink, we ever put in ourselves? Why are we advertising that? And we advertise it in the most sickly way, a way I complained about last week with some mango-flavored drink. Who are they aiming it at? You don't aim a mango-flavored drink at 50-year-olds. They've gone to the straight stuff by that point. They're not decorating their bad habit, they're just feeding it. You're trying to hook the younger generation, right? Booze is so foul. You're drinking a poison. Something severely toxic that there's so much made about the taste of it. And it's all a lie. Oh, this is so smooth. There is nothing smooth about booze. It'd be like smooth like saying, let's put some duct tape over your mouth and now we'll smoothly take the duct tape away from your mouth. You could do it in a smooth motion, but it doesn't feel smooth. It rips your face off, and that's booze, ripping your throat out when you drink it. So I say that it wouldn't be much of a story if they got to the heart of it. Two drunks got in a fight. That's what happened here. Two drunks got in a fight. You know, I was listening to quite a few comedians the last few days, and these are male, typically, comedians, and Bill Burr and Joe Rogan, and, you know, the stories they're relating are usually of other comedians in most cases. And these guys had some pretty violent, you know, stories. And, you know, in a lot of cases, drinking was involved. To them, it's just humor, entertainment to talk about it. This story, this Ray Rice story, could have been humor and entertainment. Two drunks get in a fight, what do you expect? Get them home. All right, get out of here. Go home and don't drink so much. That's how this story could have ended. But it was a famous person, and it was a man hating a woman. And there's a third part of it, which made it a big story. And yeah, the media created all this. Let's be clear, this is a media story. This isn't even a Ray Rice story, this is a media story. I say in my notes here, this story is about man-haters wanting to destroy someone and intimidate the rest. That's absolutely what this story is about. This entire incident should have been a mild punishment for Ray Rice for conduct unbecoming. You know, football has that punishment. Other than the cover-ups that came from three top Baltimore Raven people, you know, like the owner and like the three highest level people in the Baltimore Ravens organization. And these organizations, like the Ravens, I don't know, they're probably worth close to $1 billion. Be like saying, you know, the three top people at IBM or something, right? If you recall, there was a set of truck stops that I talked about. The truck stops were called Pilot Flying J. And then all the top officials were corrupt in that story. Interesting, it was in Tennessee, and I talked about how two-ish everything was. This story is in Baltimore. And Baltimore is a 3-2-5. Again, the 5 is there, right? Even in the name of the team. But then with Raven, Baltimore Raven, which is really sort of, you know, everyone always says that. It's a 9-2-2 total. Two destiny. And the two is a quality that's truth challenged. So when you are part of the Baltimore Ravens, you get truth challenged, especially if you're, you know, one of the top people, right? The people who named it the people who own it and go, yeah, my team is the Baltimore Ravens. I own the team. Well, you own a 9-2-2. Their truth challenged. They'd rather avoid the truth. They'd rather slip in a lie here or there, a bit of misdirection, rather than coming clean on the whole thing. The interesting thing about this, by the way, Ray Rice was nothing but transparent this whole time. When he was first brought before the police or whatever, he told them exactly what he did. He told his team exactly what he did. Over and over, he has told everyone exactly what he did. And when they saw the video, what he said was exactly what happened. The interesting thing is that a guy who was hammered, like his girlfriend, they're both hammered, and he fessed up and he admitted the whole thing right from the beginning. And yet, this guy is now not allowed to play football indefinitely. And the repercussions and the waves coming off of this are like a tsunami from something that should have been a kid in a bathtub. This should have been a kid in a bathtub story. And it all is because of the cover-ups by the Ravens management. They had an incentive they thought they needed to cover it up. They didn't need to cover it up. Certainly didn't help, did it? These days everything is videotaped, right? So when you cover up something that's videotaped, that's a stupid move in itself. Then the head of the NFL has been made to look bad in this. Well, the head of the NFL is, he's the head of the owners. He's the appointed figurehead for the owners. You know, when you get to be a billionaire owner, you don't want to be talking to the media all day. And so you have a figurehead in front of you, a fall guy in front of you. And he's the one that talks to the media. And then he's the one that takes the heat. And then if he causes problems, you get rid of him, right? That's all just very routine for your average billionaire. So, in addition to Ray Rice taking a lot of heat on this, by the way, even his now wife, they married, even his wife is taking heat on this. She stood behind him. She married him shortly thereafter. How bad was the incident if she ends up marrying him? The answer is, it wasn't that bad because she was hammered. When you're hammered and someone hits you or you get in a fight or whatever, you don't even remember. I'm not saying it wasn't physically violent, but hey, we're talking about a football player here. He has 50 violent plays every game. All perspective is gone on this story. There's no perspective at all. Because there's more money to be made by making this into a big story. This is the whoring of the media. This is how sleazy the media is. And there are groups behind it that are gained by it. It's like the media is wasting our money. And then they got so much money, the media, so much power, that the money is falling out of their arms onto the ground. And then these groups that gain from it are following behind the media and collecting all the money that's fallen to the ground. You know, they say the media is a buzzsaw. You know, buzzsaw, a powerful saw blade that can cut through anything. Well, they're proceeding to cut through Ray and his wife, Janae. It's interesting that Janae Palmer had a very successful name. She had sort of, you know, for this world, without getting into too many details, but basically she had a name that was kind of perfect for this world, the qualities that she had. And probably if you looked into her life, was like ideal up to that point. She marries Ray Rice, she becomes Janae Rice, and when she becomes Janae Rice, she's got a 775 total. Well, it's interesting that the incident happened in February, and all the garbage started happening in July, long after they were married. They'd been married 4 months, so she'd had that name for 4 months. Welcome to a 775 total. Her life and Ray's life are almost destroyed, almost completely destroyed. Certainly so severely disrupted. This whole Ray Rice incident is the kind of thing that would give an older person a heart attack. It's so severe. So in addition to targeting Ray Rice and saying that his wife is a victim, when in fact she's come out and supported him, she's come out and stood shoulder to shoulder, side by side with him, and this is just incensed, is that the word? This is just made the media more incensed. She was made to testify in front of the person who attacked her. Again, you look at the video and you know that these guys are drinking during dinner and then proceeded to polish off a bottle of tequila. Even if it was a small bottle, at least in my days anyway, was like 13 ounces. Let's say that they split 13 ounces, 6.5 ounces each. It takes about, like for her size, I'm guessing her body size, it would take about 2 drinks for her to be drunk. So if she had half the bottle, she was 3 levels beyond drunk. She was 300% of drunk. And even Ray Rice, no matter how big and powerful he is, if he had just the tequila alone, he was drunk. And then he had the wine earlier. It's just amazing that none of that is talked about. None of it. Not a single bit of that booze talk ever comes up. It's a fact. It's an 800-pound fact in the story that no one touches with a 10-foot pole. All right, just a little bit more on it. Ray Rice trains with a guy by the name of Kyle Jacoby. What's interesting about Kyle Jacoby is Kyle, K-Y-L-E, is the exact same combination as Rice, Ray Rice's last name. So, Mr. 538 has attracted a guy whose first name is 538. Well, that's interesting because it speaks to the point that you attract according to your thinking. If you're a 538, you attract a 538. But also, you know, a 538 has a very powerful ability to figure out the truth. Very powerful. The 5 is the truth seeker, and the 8 on the positive side stands for justice. So his friend, who watched all this happen to Ray Rice, let's just see what he has to say. By the way, his last name, Jacoby, J-A-K-O-B-E, 358, very good name. It's like Yasiel Puig's last name. Puig is 358. Jacoby is 358. We talked about Yasiel Puig having two very good names. So Mr. Jacoby here has some very good names. Very objective names. Insightful names. Let's see what he has to say. From the same story, he says, I think if you look at it objectively, it's a massive cover-up attempt. There's another quote he said, there is just so much pollution around the whole incident, it's hard to breathe. I think it perfectly summarizes the story. And so once again, the media eagerly, enthusiastically, and en masse destroys a whole family. Destroys a franchise, or certainly tries to. You know, you take Ray Rice away from the Ravens, and you've hurt that franchise. Anyway, it's all in the name of the media and the groups that benefit from the supposed bad thing that happened. The supposed bad thing was that a guy beat up his wife. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. It unfortunately probably happens thousands of times a night in America, and it could be tens of thousands. But in this case, that's not what it was. This wasn't a guy beating up his fiancée. This was a guy and his girlfriend getting smashed, clearly headed for the apartment to crash out, to just stop drinking and go to sleep. And being in such a sort of a disagreeable state of mind, the two of them, that things got physical. But they were both absolutely involved in this and absolutely at fault. Has anyone talked about the fact that Janae Palmer was drinking so much? What kind of a person drinks so much? You know, it's one thing to drink. Many people drink. I don't condone drinking, but at the same time, it's routine for people to drink. We have neighbors. When you walk around the neighborhood, you can see who puts wine bottles into their recycling container. Lots of people in this neighborhood drink. There are not a lot of stories of people beating up their spouses in this neighborhood because it's a bottle of wine at dinner. And for some people, that's considered a, you know, something nice, and that's what they do. She was drinking enough to get hammered. She was drinking and was unable to stop. That's one thing you could absolutely say. And if you are drinking and cannot stop when you should, and you're around other people who are drinking and cannot stop when they should, something bad is going to happen. So this is nothing about spousal abuse, nothing at all. For there to be purely spousal abuse incident, it involves sober parties. That's what it involves. You know, there's nothing worse than sober violence. Maybe I could summarize it that way. Once you start introducing alcohol, you have an alcohol problem. It's like they say that 50% of all fatalities in cars involve alcohol. 50%. It is astounding that alcohol is such a part of our culture. It is truly amazing. What it shows is, as much as we think we're progressive and we're aware and that we've moved on from, you know, the dirty old past, some things never change. And alcohol is one of these things that never changes. If you've ever had the misfortune of being around people who drink regularly, you realize that their whole life doesn't change. They act the same way. They make the same mistake over and over again. They teach their children to make the same mistake. It's endemic. It's an ingrained habit that they, in many cases, never break. But it's profitable. People make a lot of money off of booze. Don't mess with the money, honey. Don't mess with the billion-dollar franchise. There's just so much pollution around the whole thing, it's hard to breathe. Well, is there ever? The Ray Rice scandal, the Roger Goodell, and currently, by the way, it's all switched, all the hate, all the focus has switched to Roger Goodell, because Roger Goodell was pressured, explicitly pressured, by the Baltimore Ravens team. The Baltimore Ravens team, the top people, saw the videotapes. They knew exactly what happened. Ray Rice's lawyer saw the Inside the Elevator video, knew exactly what happened. There's even some quotes from him which used the F word to describe what happened. They pressured Roger Goodell, the league, to only give Ray Rice a 2-game fine, you know, suspension. And you know, honestly, in looking at this, if people did look at this objectively, this is a 2-game consequence. Ray Rice wasn't driving. You know, no one was really in danger in this, and as crazy as that sounds. Because one of the things about being so drunk, as these two were, is when they get into a fight, they can't fight. I drink, I get drunk, I fall down, no problem. That's the story of drunks. And so, in relative terms, yes, she fell. She hit her head against the side wall of the elevator, because there's no room in an elevator, right? There's no room for a fight there. And then she fell to the ground, and somewhere between hitting herself, her head on the sidewall and hitting her head probably when she fell, she got knocked out. But how often does that happen? People are drinking all the time. Let's say 10% of people drink. It's probably 25 or even more. Well, let's say it's 25. That's 75 million people every night are drinking in America. 75 million. Out of those 75 million, how many are drinking too much? Well, by my calculations, the average is 4 drinks a week, just for the average drinker. The average drinker is right on the edge. So out of those 75 million, let's say 25 million are drinking too much. You have 25 million people who are drunk every night. They've drank too much. Maybe they're not smashed, but they've drank too much. Let's say out of the 25 million, let's say one-fifth, one in five, are to the point that they can have trouble walking. They're really drunk. They're inebriated. They shouldn't drive. And, you know, yeah, they're at the point where they're really depressed. It's a depressant. And, you know, maybe they even get a little bit violent, let's say. Well, that's 5 million people every night. This is a story about booze. This is not a story about some guy beating his wife. They weren't even married, beating his girlfriend. But that doesn't gain traction for the two reasons mentioned. The sponsors don't want that, definitely not. It's the opposite of what they want to talk about. And it's just not a story. Two drunks get in a fight, making the national news? No. But we've got a spin on it. All right, I've gone around that subject enough, I suppose. It's just very insightful to learn how completely dishonest the media is. Completely. They are complete whores. They are complete pimps. Complete criminals, really, if you think about it. They display criminal levels of negligence of the truth all the time. Look at fluoride. Whether you've, you know, figured it out or not, you will if you haven't figured it out already. You know, the fluoride scam is a massive criminal enterprise. And the media is absolutely at the center of it. Absolutely. If the media even had a hint of an inclination to be honest about it, fluoridation would stop overnight. It's interesting that that really detailed article, which it really laid it all out there, that came out 6 months after the original incident. 6 months later. And yet the people involved, the top level people involved, knew probably in one day. But it took 180 days for that truth to leak out and trickle out. By the way, Ray Rice was arguably one of the finest ambassadors of the NFL. He's an outstanding guy. The amount of charitable work that he does, the amount of care in that guy is very high. And then one night he drank too much. Don't blame the booze. You know, what if Ray Rice had shot somebody? You know, we never blame guns, right? Because we all want to have guns, right? What if Ray Rice, you know, same story, same guy, same amazing guy, and he shoots somebody one night? Well, yeah, he can get arrested and all that stuff, but we would blame the gun. If he did something with a gun, we would blame the gun or who he was hanging out with. But in this case, because it's booze instead, we don't blame the booze. That's absolutely fascinating. And yet, booze is clearly a bigger altering factor. Booze alters people much more effectively than guns do. Many people have a gun, they like shooting a gun, they go to a gun range, they shoot it, they put it away, and they do something else. Once you start drinking, it's very hard to do something else. Booze is highly addictive. And that old physical addiction, as well as the mental, emotional addiction, it's physically addictive. And so you get to a point where you can't stop drinking. Your body is now dependent on it. And it's so inebriating. It makes you so unable to think clearly. It takes away your willpower, your control, you know, when you're in the middle of it, you can't do anything. You can't walk. You can't think. You know, you're not independent. So then you sleep it off. When you sleep it off and you wake up, guess what? Your body's like, hey, where's the booze? I need it. I'm addicted to it. What a vicious cycle. Booze is so fantastically vicious. And this story is really about the vicious media trying to avoid talking about vicious booze, and so they find some fall guys instead. Really horrific. Alright, another story. This is an NBA basketball story. Just happened to run across this, I think, yesterday, and thought, hey, that's a good one to talk about. There's a guy, some basketball player I've never heard of, Rex Chapman. And he's accused of stealing $14,000 worth of stuff. You know, first of all, how easy is that? If you're in a store and, you know, you pick up a chocolate bar and you're holding it in your hand when you walk out the door, it's pretty easy to take that. I'm not, you know, encouraging it. I'm just saying, I mean, I've seen it. I've cared for people and I've seen them pocket a few chocolate bars, you know. The point is that a store is probably, in most cases, unless they saw the whole thing, they're not going to make a big deal out of a chocolate bar, because you don't want to embarrass people. You don't want to be wrong. You don't want to risk your career, your store's reputation, and risk losing a customer for a chocolate bar. But once you start getting into things that have a value, and this story is about $14,000 worth of value, then how does the guy get out the door? That's what I want to know. Well, the bizarre thing in this story, apparently he was in an Apple store. So this is a technology store. Now, anytime I've been around technology in the last 15, 20 years in a store, it's all wired. It's all cabled. And the little demo phone they got on the counter, it's not even a working phone, right? It's got something glued to the back or bolted into it. It doesn't have a working display. It's meant to give you a feel for the size of the product, and then the salesman gives you the pitch, right? Surely, at the point in the Apple store where you're touching products, surely that's when you're at the counter. I haven't been to these stores, but I've looked in the Apple stores. I have no interest in Apple products. I don't respect them. But when you look in the Apple stores, you see masses of people, and then you see counters, and then there's like an area where you pay. Surely you go to the counter and you say, I'd like an iPhone 95, whatever the model is. And they reach under the counter. I remember once I bought a laptop, and I bought it from a little store, and I don't even know how I heard about this, but this guy was doing a good little business. All legit, but this is when laptops were becoming small. Interesting, when I bought this particular laptop, it's one of the smallest I've ever owned. It worked fantastic. It was an IBM laptop. And anyway, I said, yeah, I'm here, I'm interested in this laptop. And he like showed it to me, because he had it right there on the counter. And I'm like, yeah, I'll get one of those. He reached underneath where he was like sitting at the counter there, and he just pulled out this little box about the size of a briefcase, and he's like, okay, there you go. We rang it up and I walked out, like 5 minute transaction. $2,000 laptop at the time. It did me very well for years. I was traveling all the time then, and I needed a laptop that could do everything for me, and it did it. 3 years, and then I passed it on to other people, and as far as I know, it's still going. IBM can potentially make some really great products, really reliable. There's many things about IBM products I don't care for, but the reliability, oh boy, they are right up there. But just what I remember was him just reaching under the counter and very manufacturedly going, here you go. Well, surely that's the way it is at the Apple store.
Yeah, I want the iPhone. Well,
here you go. Here's your little box. Anyway, this guy, apparently this Apple store has a self-checkout. You're selling a product that's worth hundreds of dollars. If you buy two of them, let's say thousands of dollars, and you have a self-checkout? What am I missing here? What the heck is going on? You can't afford a $10 an hour staff to process people's orders? I got very confused by that part of the story. So this guy was going through the self-checkout, and in quoting the story, he made it appear as if he was using the self-checkout, but he left without paying. And apparently he went back to the store and he repeated the whole cycle 7 times and then sold the phones for cash. Now, isn't it obvious, again, this is not mentioned in this story, but isn't it obvious that this Rex Chapman has a drug problem? Isn't it obvious? Why is he stealing phones and selling them for cash? He's getting paid, let's say, hundreds of thousands of dollars minimum, maybe $1 million a year. Why is he stealing phones? In fairness, it doesn't have to be a drug problem, but he's certainly got a money management problem, that's for sure. How could he go back 7 times and no one is clued in? No one went, hey, we did an inventory and we're missing 3 phones. How can this store operate like that with that level of self-checkout? That's my bizarre story of the day. That's almost as dumb as the shooting the microwave energy from the moon and thinking that we're going to harvest energy, sun energy on the moon and ship it to the earth. Which, of course, that wasn't really what that story was about. It was about getting us used to microwave as being a good thing. That's what that story was really about. Anyway, let's have a look at Mr. Chapman's name. We talked about in the previous story how Baltimore Ravens 922 total. The 2 is truth challenged. What's this guy's name? Rex. Rex 562. All right, he's got the 2. And when it's coupled with the 5, I think of the 562 quality as like an artful dodger. The 5 is always considers like 10 times as many possible things, outcomes, as other qualities. If you're disinclined to tell the truth, and you have another quality which is thinking of 10 other possibilities, a person with 5s and 2s is going to has a potential for being very crafty in how they avoid being honest. Let's put it that way. Well, what about his last name? Does that help things here? Let's have a look. Chapman. 292. Uh-oh. Just by itself, the 292 is the most truth-challenged. Doesn't get more truth-challenged than that. So you got a guy who's already an artful dodger first name. And we're just talking the quality. I'm not saying that Mr. Rex Chapman is this way. I'm saying that the name combination, Rex, can be described this way. I don't know anything about the man. Maybe he never even took these things, right? He's innocent until proven guilty, right? I'm just going by these names and giving you an analysis of these names. If you had these names, this is the kind of thing that would happen. These names fit the story. Just like some of those names I analyzed in the previous story where the guy had the 191 first name, Jaw Reed, and then Reed, 549 last name, and a 1 destiny. And how I said, guilty. As soon as you look at those combinations, he's 3 different 1s out of 6 positions, and then a 549, the 9 adding power to the 5. The 5 can be very aggressive. 1 destiny. That Jaw Reed, I mean, it just shouts violence. That's what that name shouts. And this name, Chapman, shouts, truth challenged. You know, I could use a different word instead of saying truth challenge, but I think you get the idea. So, your name matters. Your child's name matters. This is not a small factor in life, and you'll see this over and over again. Kind of amazing, an NBA level player did this. Wow, that's an amazing story. Talk about pointing at the numbers. You can't get more clear than that. There's a story in the New Yorker. The title is The Transformation. Is it possible to control cancer without killing it? First of all, just think about that. Be like saying, is it possible to live with a mass murderer without arresting him? Do we want to do this? I got confused by that right away. Well, once again, they don't want to cure cancer. They want us to get the cancers, the 99%. They are the doctors. They are the people that make the money from it. And also, how can you change the world when you have cancer? They want us to have debilitating problems. They want us to be barely alive. That's ideal. Because they have all the money. Even if they have to spend some of that money, the system has to spend some money keeping someone alive. It's nothing to them. They have all the money. Money is nothing to these people because they have it all. What is something to these people is they don't want people healthy. What would be even worse is if people had balanced names. Because when you have a balanced name, you can see things the most clearly and you can avoid the most problems. Automatically, with a balanced name, you don't desire many, not all, but many of the things that people with unbalanced names desire. Like that guy who was truth challenged. You give him a balanced name, he doesn't desire to steal, if he did, steal phones from a store 7 times. He doesn't desire to do that. He's like, it's a more rational name. You're like, I don't think so. That's a stupid idea. Let's say I get away with it once. What are the mathematical odds of getting away with it 7 times? Well, they're 0, aren't they? Or negative. This guy kind of beat the odds at least a few times there. All right, this dreadful story. Is it possible to control cancer without killing it? There, Mr. Cancer. Nice cancer. Just keep patting it on the head. Nice cancer. Nice cancer. So some doctor is presenting his findings. I'm going to try and skip most of this here. Some kind of surgery aims to remove the entire growth from the body. Chemo are toxic. Radiation is toxic. And this new drug, instead of killing the leukemic cells, coaxes them into maturing, into functioning blood cells. Now, this is just simply not how life works. You don't take a drug to get better. Talked about drugs before. Drugs mask symptoms. The healing crisis says that we go through these steps. And when we are on the level part of the step where we normally walk, we currently aren't sick. And when we start to go down a step, that takes a few hours, a few days to go down that step. And as we are going down that step, we are sick. And then we end up at the next flat spot. Our cold goes away, but our health has gone down one step. Well, drugs just make you go down the step faster. They're poisons. They're absolute poisons. They're unnatural. They're all to do with masking symptoms and not making anything better. And the proof of that is the amount of side effects from drugs is boggling. 10, 20 side effects from a drug is not uncommon. Look, I'm in this business. I'm in the business of caring for people. They take drugs, I have to give them the drugs. And part of that is you have to fill up paperwork so that you know, you personally know the side effects of these drugs. I've had to write them down on a piece of paper, look them up and write them down. And let me tell you, they don't give you enough space on that page to write down all the side effects. Not at all. They typically give you one piece of paper for one person. What you really need, and by the way, in that page, there's many different questions related to that one person's drugs. What you really need is at least a page just for the side effects from one drug. That's how many side effects drugs have. No exaggeration, 10, 20, 30 side effects, one drug. The more you know, like that ad campaign, the more you know, the more you don't want to do drugs. Absolutely. So this guy's pushing a drug and basically saying, my drug's better than their drugs. That's the essence of this story. Yes, this drug has a different tactic, but when you poison yourself with drugs, if you think that this is going to make you better, well, you're the perfect victim. Step right up. So, just my little comment, I say all of this pretense about cancer, let's pretend we can control it. We need money for research and all this garbage, rather than avoiding the problem, right? The cancer-causing foods, the cancer-causing behaviors. It's disgusting. But luckily, only the lives of innocent people are at stake. So that's a relief. This was a story. It says, taking a health hazard home. This was in the New York Times, in the science section, apparently. A study finds that pork workers retain bacteria on their being for days. Just a little summary from the article. A new study of a small group of workers at an industrial hog farm. Isn't that a nice way of saying a slaughterhouse? Isn't that nice? An industrial hog farm. Oh, you're farming the hogs. It's not a hog farm. It's a slaughterhouse. So these workers at a slaughterhouse in North Carolina have found that they continue to carry antibiotic-resistant bacteria over several days, raising new questions for public health officials. Does it really raise questions? No. It provides answers. The answer is, anything to do with slaughtering animals is toxic and dangerous. We shouldn't do it. We shouldn't be breathing it at all. They should have gas masks or, you know, oxygen masks or independent oxygen supplies while they're doing this work. They should have a hazmat suit on. This is supremely toxic, and obviously what it's saying is that there's toxic bacteria on the food. It can't just be only on them. No, this doesn't raise questions. This answers a lot of questions about how toxic meat is. Anyway, it raises questions to public health officials struggling to contain the spread of such pathogens. Oh, yeah, they are, sure. One of the things that mentioned graphically in the article, I'll have the link, is that they measured the bacteria in the nose, in the sinuses of these workers. You know, it's not just a fleck on your person, on your outer person. This bacteria is inside these workers. Really horrific. I mean, when it's in your nose, right, your nose is warm, moist, there's food there because there's, you know, skin cells and blood, if the bacteria can tap into that. They can live there, absolutely. You know, one of the big things to realize if you really want to be healthy and you're worried about germs and whatnot is keep things dry. That's it. And ironically, use a lot of water. So, when you are dealing with something that you're worried about, use a lot of water, dilute it, and then make sure everything gets really dry. Because most stuff can't live when things are really dry. So, a lot of water to dilute. And then the little bit that's left, mop it up. Use paper towels. I'm a real convert to paper towels. I have to thank my better half for that. The hand towel, the cloth towel, it starts off moist, and it gets wetter, and then it gets maybe, if you're lucky, slightly dry, and then it never stops being moist. It's actually a pretty stinky proposition, which is why you have to wash them frequently, right? But the point is, they are germ carriers. Well, paper towel starts off very dry, it's in packaging, very clean, very hygienic, and then it's very absorbent, and so it absorbs a lot of water, and then you get rid of it immediately, and then you wash your hands and dry your hands with a new towel and get rid of that immediately. You know, you're pretty close to medical doctor level of sterilization when you use paper towels. It's something to think about. Anyway, raising questions, taking a health hazard home. Well, whatever you do, guys, don't figure out the solution to the problem. I'm pretty sure that solution involves people not working with dead animals. I'm pretty sure that's the way to go. Maybe I should have had a spoiler alert there, telling you, you know, I'm going to tell you the answer to how to avoid these problems with these dead animals. Got my dog at my feet tonight, it feels like night. I woke up and I was a little bit more tired than usual, even though I had plenty of sleep. Got going here around 4 in the morning, something like that, 3:30 actually, I think it was. And anyway, our dog, you know, trying to come up with ways to keep him healthier and happier in his later years. One of the things he's done and started to do lately in the last 6 months is he'll just sleep at our feet. You know, he loves people. A golden retriever loves people. Just something about that breed, that it's really wonderful. If you're a loving person, or if you have a family and you want the family to be loving, get a golden, as opposed to a different breed, is what I mean. I mean, if you don't want to have a dog, fine, don't have a dog. But if you're looking at dogs, it's very hard to compete with a golden. With our golden, he was a rescue, so we didn't exactly choose him. And he's already a year old. He already had some bad habits, mostly bad habits. But just the innate goodness of these dogs is something else. So the point is that he tends to hang around where we are anyway. If I move to another room, within minutes he will be there, and he will crash out right there. He just wants to be right with you. That's what he loves. Our pit bull, she has an area. She has the couch. That's her couch. And we will go and, you know, we'll be having dinner in another room. there may be, you know, some table scraps at the end of the meal. She will be just on the couch, and then if there are scraps, not very often, but if there are scraps to be given out, you know, we call them. Tank, our golden, is already there. She will come from the other room. She will have her scraps, and she'll go back to her couch, you know. The pit bull, she's in the category of somebody that just wants to know that everything is calm, cool, and collected. Everything is settled. Everything is safe. That's what she wants. When everything is safe, then all's right with the world, right? That's why she's such a good guard dog. As soon as anything unusual happens at the porch, she's barking. And she is letting you know in no uncertain terms that there's something wrong. Elka is not the kind of dog that's going to err on the side of being a little bit too quiet when something is going wrong. You're going to know. The funny thing with Tank, you know, he's sort of the opposite in a way. He's not a great guard dog. He often will bark when he's outside. When people come along that he wants them to pat him, he will be running towards them. He will be wagging his whole body, and he will bark like he's being a guard dog. And all he wants is them to pat him. He just lives for that. Yesterday, there was an older couple walking along, and he was out there, and they were patting him, and they really enjoyed it. And I got a chance to, you know, talk to them a little bit. And Tank's at the stage where it's like people are even more important to him. That's really kind of interesting, the different breeds. And this dog's got a lot of love in his heart. He's more happy, you know, being around people than just being a dog. To Tank, being a dog is just the secondary part of his life. We have food up for them. We have two chunks of time during the day, big chunks of time when they can eat. Some people only feed their dogs once a day. We do it twice. And Tank will just leave his food alone. Like, it's not uncommon. You put food out in the morning, for example, like I've done already, and it's been an hour and a half, and he hasn't even touched it. You know, the block of time I have, you know, just a routine, right? So it's a fixed block of time. It's like 4 or 5 hours in the morning, 4 or 5 hours at night, and then we put the food up. And the reason we put it up is that when Tank eats, he will eat everything that's there. So we measure out his food, and he can eat all of his food if he wants to. But then he'll, at a later moment, he will want to eat all of the other dog's food because he just doesn't like to have the food around. And whether that's, you know, sort of part of the instinct of a dog that they don't want to smell the food because that can attract predators, that's our main theory. Whatever the reason is, he will just demolish the food that's there. It's a problem. The other thing he'll do, he'll flick at it with his nose, and he wants to sort of bury the food. He wants to hide it. And he'll make a real mess. So that's what started us on the rationing the times that the food is on the ground. But very commonly, he will leave it alone. Then when he eats it, he'll wolf it all down in a matter of a minute or two. And then he goes back to not thinking about food again. Whereas our pit bull, she's a rescue. Food is, you know, obviously was at a premium when she was young. She lives and dreams food, you know, to quite an extent. But she's so smart that she can control herself. And when she knows that scraps are coming, and believe me, she knows when scraps are coming her way. She waits, perfect timing, bang, right at the moment when the wife is calling her to the kitchen, she's on her way. Commonly. To the second, to the fraction of the second, she knows exactly when it's ready. She wasn't hanging out earlier. She just knows the exact moment. It really, the intelligence there is really astounding. How many humans could time it that well? I don't think we could. There's a couple of reasons why not. Like when we're hungry, we're going to be, you know, hounding the other person early. You know, is it ready yet? Is it ready yet? And just the way human attention spans are, chunks of time are going to go by. You're doing something else, right? Well, Elka's not doing something else. She's either sleeping or thinking about food. It's big on her mind. All right, there is a story here. This is an unusual story. Phil Ivey. I don't know if you've heard of Phil Ivey. Phil Ivey's a poker player, a famous poker player, one of the best in the world. When No Limit Hold'em became extremely popular, say starting roughly 5 years ago, Phil Ivey was one of the big names already. I was going to say an inveterate gambler. I don't know if inveterate is the right word, but it comes to mind. He's a non-stop gambler. He has his own private jet, like a Learjet or equivalent. He flies, you know, casinos invite him, and he'll fly there. And, of course, he has his own private room where he plays. And this guy is an all-gambling-all-the-time kind of guy. Well, the headline of the story is on CNN says, Phil Ivey Jr., Edge Sorting Scam. According to court documents, Ivy set up 4 sessions of Baccarat in 2012. For each session, so this is like, he's at a casino, he's in the private gambling rooms, and they're like, you know, what's your pleasure? Which game do you want to play, right? They will cater to you entirely. Whatever game you want, that's the game that they will serve you. Anyway, so he wanted Baccarat. And for each session, he requested a private area in the pit, an automatic shuffler for the cards, and a dealer who spoke Mandarin Chinese. Phil Ivey is an American. I wasn't aware that he spoke Chinese. I wouldn't be surprised if he does not. Phil Ivey was accompanied by Sun, just giving the last name of this other person, who communicated with the card dealer in Mandarin to instruct the dealer on how to turn the cards as they were dealt. Once Ivy identified the good and bad cards based on their markings, the printing on the back of them, he was able to tilt the odds of the game in his favor. And on 5 separate occasions he played, or 4, and he won $2.4 million in April, $1.6 million in May, $4.8 million in July, and $825,000 in October of 2012. So this is a big scam, man. This is like getting towards $10 million. Phil Ivey's true motive, intention, and purpose in negotiating these playing arrangements was to create a situation in which he could surreptitiously, sneakily, manipulate what he knew to be a defect in the playing cards in order to gain an unfair advantage over Borgata. Borgata is the casino. This alleged incident of cheating is not the first time Ivy has been accused of using edge sorting techniques, according to the lawsuit. In August of 2012, Ivy was accused of cheating at Crockford's Casino in London in a game of Punto Banco, which is similar to Baccarat. So I guess I didn't excerpt all of the story, but the essence of it is that the pattern on the back of the cards should be symmetrical. It should obviously be the same for every card in the deck. But some decks won't be like that. They will have defects in the cards so that the ace or whatever, certain cards anyway, have a misprint on the back or they have a non-symmetry on the back. You know, something's chopped off or something's noticeably different. I mean, you have to hand it to Phil Ivey. He was very astute here to study the cards to that level while still playing, right? He's still playing. And to see slight imperfections and to then have to memorize for each card that had an imperfection. What was the imperfection? What did it look like? And what was the value of the card? Not a trivial little scam, this one. And really, honestly, of course, it's the casino's fault. Really, when you look at it, Ivy did nothing wrong here. He was merely exploiting a weakness of the casino. It'd be like the dealer had a whole big stack of cash and, you know, they're supposed to put it. There's a way of disposing of your cash. You have a little opening and you put the cash there and you have a little pusher that pushes it down into a slot. You know, and it'd be like the casino dealer leaving, you know, piles of money lying around. And then someone takes some of the money. You know, whose fault is that? It starts with the dealer in that case. And in this case, it starts with the people who made the cards. They allowed imperfect cards to be shipped to the casino. The casino never checked the cards properly. The dealer never noticed that the cards were not proper. You know, there were several levels of mistakes in this, and Phil Ivey was just the opportunist. But still, let's have a look at Phil Ivey. Phil, 999. The 9 is a specialist. Well, you can see what he was specializing in this case. Ivey, 527. Accident looking for a place to happen. But also, the 5 is super analytical. That's how he thinks. Phil Ivey thinks like the 9 and the 5. And then he has a 527 total, so he looks into the future 5-ishly. Well, the 5 is looking for the angle. Non-stop, the 5's looking for the angle. The 5's are good in sales, and it's because the salesman is looking for the angle. The salesman is looking for the thing that will reach you, the customer. You don't respond to it's cheaper, but you respond to quality. Okay, that salesman will remember that, and he will play the quality game with you. So, Phil, Ivy, 527. The 7 expression, that's the quality that hides what they're thinking. That's the secret of quality. That's the, it's a deep thinking quality, but it avoids the limelight, plays in the private room kind of thing, and can be very... The 7 can be very materialistic, very focused on money, on the negative side of that quality. It's not meant to be. The 7 is more naturally meant to be out in nature, being artistic in a natural way, like fashioning the clay with your hands kind of thing. painting. But on the negative side, that I have seen it many times, the seven can become very materialistic. I remember when I came into the organization that I was a part of for many decades, and philosophical organization, and another guy came at the same time as me. What was interesting was we had our first name combinations were identical, our month of birth was identical, and our day of birth was identical. We had some real similarities, and yet he was born a year earlier than me. And so he was seven and I'm an eight. Well, there was that seven. And so the primary difference between us was he was a seven, I was an eight. You know, they say the eight is like the money bags, the quality that's, you know, sort of focused on money. But the eight also inclines itself towards being a humanitarian in the biggest sense, to be the philanthropist. Well, a seven is like supposed to be the thinker, but it can incline itself towards money, really on the negative side of the quality. It's not like, you know, money is evil, but it's when you obsessively focus on money, your life is out of balance. So Mr. Ivy here, 527, 7 destiny, 7 total, 7 destiny, he's absolutely, completely focused on money in his life. I guess it turns out I'm looking at the link for the story, and it shows his name, because it says Casino Sue's Poker Champ Philip Ivy. So his name is Philip, with two L's, which is 911. So 911, 527 last name, 538 total. Well, there's that successful total, the 8 destiny, right? And then he also apparently goes by Phil Ivy Jr., which also has a 5-3 total. It's just interesting when you have someone like this, they only have a few qualities in their name. Really, only four numbers are showing up in his name. Five, I guess, if you count Philip. But there's nine numbers, but he's only showing four or five of them. So it makes it very easy to study this person because they have a narrower set of variables. Well, a very interesting story. I never would have imagined that Phil Ivey would get involved in something like this. But, you know, if you think about it, these guys log tens of hours doing something that's actually pretty boring. This is the thing about casinos and Vegas and all that. It's one of the most boring things you can do. I get bored in a matter of minutes when I'm at a casino. I've only been a couple of times. And what I, of course, enjoy doing is going around and looking at different people and different games. But even then, in a matter of an hour or two, I don't want to be there. Staying overnight is pushing it. I don't know how people can, you know, do this for multiple days of a week in Vegas, or even a weekend would be kind of unbearably long. Well, imagine this guy has done this for decades, tens of years. Wow. So the point is that your mind is going to think about other things while you're holding your cards, because the cards, after a while, it's all muscle memory, it's all automatic, right? You know exactly what's going on. And so your mind goes on to other things, especially when you have a five-ish mind like Mr. Ivy does. Fascinating story. I think we'll get to the of the weeks. Bad driver of the week. I had a submission for a bad driver of the week, and so I'm going to pass that story on. This person was waiting at a light, waiting to turn right. They're in the right-hand lane of their direction of traffic, and they're going to turn right. So you're looking into the intersection to see if, because you have the red light, you're seeing if anyone is coming through. So from your left, from your 90-degree left, the cross traffic, is there anyone going through? Because if there's no one going through, even on a red light in this particular state, you know, you can turn right. And there was a car on this person's left that was in the turn lane. So they were trying to turn left. In other words, they were about to leave the intersection without going through it, you might say. Leave it to this driver's left, not go through it. So this person was sort of watching the whole thing. And then this person suddenly got out of the left turn lane, got into the through traffic lane, drove through the intersection. So in itself, it's quite dangerous, right? That's how accidents happen, changing lanes in the intersection like that. Especially that level of a change. You know, they say even if there are, let's say there are two lanes that drive straight through an intersection, they say you're not supposed to change lanes even amongst those two lanes that are driving straight through. And it's something like within 100 feet of the intersection, you shouldn't do it within 100 feet of it, and then I imagine within 100 feet after the intersection, just try and avoid your lane changes anywhere near an intersection, even the most seemingly innocent kind. And it makes sense. Well, this person, they changed from the left lane to the through lane, went through the intersection. Person who submitted the story to me, they were watching all this, weren't doing anything. And then the person wagged their finger at our submitter. While they were driving through, like, I'm driving through here, don't do anything. Well, this driver who submitted this wasn't doing anything. But, you know, the person who was in the wrong was wagging their finger at the other driver. And, you know, that's exactly how problems happen. We can't see our own faults. And on this occasion, because the person who was watching it all go and unfold was extra diligent, nothing happened. But it could have. Something easily could have happened. Another story here on traffic. This was in Florida. Waldo, Florida. Florida, by the way, 742 for a state. It's interesting how state names absolutely have an influence on the stories in general from those states. It's not necessarily a major influence in some cases, but it depends. But it can be. Everything sets a tone. The country name very much sets a tone. Very much. So this is in Waldo, Florida. It's a town of 1,000 people, so this is a very small town. 2 miles of highway are involved. A small segment of highway that runs through Waldo requires drivers to speed up and slow down 6 times. 6 times in 2 miles. So, you know, at highway speeds, you could drive 2 miles in 2 minutes. So in 2 minutes, you have to make 6 speed changes. So that's 3 changes per minute, 1 every 20 seconds. That's pretty intricate. You start off at 65. I guess you come into this town. Now you're going 55. Then it becomes 45. Then back to 55. Then down to 45 again. Then back to 55. And then the real gotcha, 35. Well, you can figure out where the cops were in that little formula. AAA itself has called out the town for its ridiculous speed limit changes and has even posted a billboard outside the town limits to warn drivers. Now the state has stepped in to take control of Waldo's traffic enforcement. The situation simmered for years until this month when Police Chief Mike Szabo was suspended, apparently in response to an investigation by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement into suspected improprieties in the way officers write tickets. This guy, the chief, who was removed from his job, quote, exited with allegations of demanding officers to write 12 tickets per shift. He was replaced by a different guy, Corporal Kenneth Smith. Smith, however, wasn't a capable replacement. The officers also leveled allegations at the August 26 meeting against Kenneth Smith, who had been picked to fill in for Szabo. The officers complained that Smith had, among other things, mishandled evidence. The city council then suspended Smith. Well, what are the qualities here? Mike Szabo. So now we've talked about Rex, if you'll recall, the player who allegedly stole 7 phones. Truth challenged. Mike, 562, same combination as Rex. And then Szabo, 729, when you add the two together, 382, 2 destiny. So Mr. Szabo is mega two-ish. Well, so you're the police chief in a small town. You got a money problem, right? You know, the police force is a cost. It's a cost side of the equation, right? And small town, how much money do they have for cops, right? It turned out, by the way, and this was in the title of the story, but I didn't excerpt it. The title of the story says, 7-officer police force. Now, why do you have 7 people in a town of 1,000? That in itself is kind of weird. Anyway, 7-officer police force wrote 11,000 traffic tickets last year. 11,000. You know, we have a community right near where we live here, the next community over to the south, and they are very big on traffic enforcement. They have those, you know, radar vans. They're out just about constantly. Probably every other time I'm driving in that direction, I see these vans somewhere. They have ridiculous speed zone changes. And, you know, the net effect is you hate them. You hate the town. It's a pure money grab. It has nothing to do with safety. In this city where I live, drivers are very good. There's very little speeding. Traffic moves briskly. Roads are designed efficiently. And that's really the key. When you design the roads well, you don't have traffic problems. I hardly ever see accidents. I hardly ever see people giving out tickets. I hardly ever see a driver driving really dangerously. What I mean by that is, like, let's say 30 miles an hour faster than other traffic. I saw one recently. It was such an anomaly, I still remember it. And it's the kind of thing where you really hope that guy gets a ticket. That's the guy that should have the book thrown at him. But most people know. Most people, they're more similar in their driving than anything else. For every 10,000 good drivers, there's one lunatic. That's really the way it is nowadays. So the idea of trying to give out tickets is pretty ugly and pretty inappropriate in itself, to really try and systematize it, especially when you start putting quotas on it. Or like this community to the south where they always had the vans out, and the speed goes from like 45 down to 30. It doesn't need to be 30. You're just driving through this little tiny little town or suburb. What's the word I'm looking for? This little, you know, adjacent community. It's adjacent to a bigger area. It's a blip. They have one or two gas stations. They have almost no reasons to go into the town. It's a blip. And that blip is trying to make some money from the substantial flow of traffic going through their little community. And I really don't respect them at all for that. Instead of it being from 45 to 30, it could be 45 to 35, number one. And then number two, skip the radar patrol altogether. You have traffic lights. You can control traffic very effectively with traffic lights. This particular place has three traffic lights all back to back. There's three or four? Four. You can synchronize them. You can design them so that there's nothing to be gained by trying to run the lights. Like, you can desynchronize them so that, you know, you can make it go red to red to red if you wanted to, so that people just, they get slowed down by the lights. An interesting thing is, approaching this little micro community from either direction, there's nothing much going on. What I mean is, it isn't like there's like children and a school ground and everything else. It's the opposite. From the north, it's very industrial. Huge wide, like four lanes wide, which means, you know, nothing's happening. You're going from four lanes down to two because the road sort of splits and it goes two this way, two that way. So you're in an industrial area, so there's very few threats that could get hit by a car. You have lots of lanes, so people aren't, you know, chomping at the bit to pass someone and doing something reckless. Four lanes each way, by the way. And then you're, as soon as you come into the two lanes and, you know, the more congested area, well, there's a traffic light there. Just make people hit the traffic light. That will slow them down to nothing. Then when you give them a green, make the next one go red, or have it so that if you speed, it goes red in your face, right? I'm not normally in favor of that, but if you supposedly have a speeding problem, which there's no evidence they do, you could do this. Anyway, they create a huge traffic jam. I absolutely loathe this community. Many times I thought of sending them a nasty letter kind of thing, but of course it would have no influence. What I would be basically saying to them is, I just want to let you know, this is just a one more vote. I personally boycott your town. I go out of my way to not use any of the services in your little community because of your traffic policy. So good luck. I hope you go bankrupt. Have a nice day. So anyway, Mr. Szabo was Tuish, very Tuish. Tuish in the first name, the Artful Dodger, kind of like the crafty about trying to come up with a way of getting something for nothing, first name. Two Destiny, not inclined to be honest. And then what about his replacement, right? Kenneth Smith. Kenneth 145, well, there's that 5 again, right? It's a, you know, it's a different combination, but still, there's the 5 again. Smith 966, nothing wrong there. Add them together, 112 total, 2 Destiny again. So the 2 Destiny chief was replaced by the 2 Destiny corporal, and then the corporal mishandled evidence. Well, what's another, that's a euphemism, right? What's really going on when you mishandle evidence? You cover something up. Just like in the Ray Rice scandal, right? That's what's really going on there. It's not mishandled like, whoops, I touched it and I put a fingerprint on it. That's not what they're talking about here. Sorry, no. And again, I'm speculating based on the guy's name. I think, based on the name of this guy and of his predecessor, that mishandled evidence means cover-up. So I say about this story, it's the two-quality in action. This is what happens when you have a lot of two-quality around. It's really not good. The two is one of the most chronic qualities. Some qualities, they look at things and they go, well, what's the right thing to do? I'm thinking about the one quality. One quality goes, what's the right thing to do? And they start doing it. Well, if they find out later, let's say they're trying to be healthy and they're like, what's the right thing to do? And someone says, I should eat meat, and they start eating meat. And then if they find out later on, well, meat's a bad idea, well, they change. And they start doing something else. Well, to change, it takes strength. It takes willpower. It takes discipline. The two lacks that. The two lacks that more than any other number. This is why in the workplace, some people have it in for you. Usually they're the people that are part of that big group of people that you don't go to lunch with. They're two-ish. The two desperately needs the support of others. And the two is jealous and lacking in confidence and jealous and fearful of those who are better than them, those who are more, you know, strong-minded, more independent, do a better job. But they have the ability to marshal other people, to use other people. And so then they plant thoughts and seeds into other people. And these are the people that appear to be the sweetest people. I'm thinking of one in a company I worked for. I stopped working for them a few years back, but this person on the surface just gave off the nicest vibrations. Well, she got fired. She got fired because despite it being one of the most important things that we were required to do, she was breaking the rules and it involved the clients and it involved actually abuse of the clients. And as soon as she left, the clients cleared up. The thing that she had been doing to them immediately went away. We didn't even know it was happening. Well, you know, we suspected because, you know, you can tell if someone is acting in a way that you respect or not. This person was very nonchalant with the clients. These clients at times will assault you. Sure enough, she got assaulted one time. It was off on compensation for weeks. But there were other things. And as I say, this person, it turned out, was breaking the rules big time. And how interesting that it's the likable one. The one that, oh, hello there. The non-stop fake smile on this person's face was unpleasant to contemplate. All right, my re-listen of the week. Bill Hex's last interview. This is how this particular YouTube is being billed on YouTube. I don't know if it was the last interview or not. It's certainly possible. I think he was being interviewed in England. It was really worth a watch. Bill Hex is just one of these really interesting guys, for sure. Hex 955. You know, that truth. Being a slave to truth. The 955 is a slave to truth. And you know, poor Billy died at like age 32. Pancreatic cancer or something pretty horrific. But he was interesting to the end and he's really left a legacy. He reminds a bit of Jimi Hendrix, who was also very five-ish. Hendrix is five-ish. Just trying to work it out. I think hell. Hendrix is hell. H-E-N-D-R-I-X is the same combination as H-E-L-L. And interesting as Jimmy 977, and then 551, 538 total. Well, we've been talking about 538s all day today. Ray Rice, 538, his trainer Kyle, 538, and then Phil Ivey Jr., 538 total, and then Philip Ivey, 538 total. This is the 538 day. Anyway, the truth of the five. And so Bill Hicks, Bill 988, Bill had the nines in both the first and last name. The nine quality has the broadest perspective. You have to say, in looking at Bill Hicks and his body of work, he had a broad perspective. So Bill 988, Hicks 955, 944 total. That's very discordant for destiny. I'm sure Bill Hicks worked very hard, didn't necessarily make a lot of money. He would probably say over and over he wasn't into it for the money, and I believe that. But I have a feeling he didn't leave behind a large financial legacy. But he had that nine, all those nines, and the nine cares very deeply and wants to help others, and they want to inspire others to, in Bill's case, he wanted people to think. Not uncommonly screaming into the microphone. He was a screamer. One of the most well-known screamers. Anyway, from this last interview, I just excerpted a quote here I thought was worth looking at. People are frustrated not having their voice of reason confirmed. This is a very concentrated phrase. Let's have a look at it. So people get frustrated when their own internal voice of reason, their own internal logic, their own internal sense of what is right and what is wrong, when it doesn't get confirmed. Well, we live in a world where reason does not get confirmed. Absolutely not. That's part of living in a controlled world. You are constantly not having your voice of reason confirmed. Constantly. The better your voice of reason, the less it is confirmed. So I completely empathize, sympathize, and agree with Bill Hicks that people do indeed get frustrated when their voice of reason is not confirmed. And so the interesting thing, you know, we were just talking about someone who was two-ish, and those two-ish people in the workplace that seem so nice but aren't. Similarly, the people that are really frustrated, they probably have the most to offer. The people who seem the most disagreeable, the most critical, and the most frustrated, not in all cases, in some cases they just have a bad attitude. But assuming they have a good attitude, but they're very frustrated, they probably have the most to offer. They have the loudest voice of reason in their own head. They know what's right and what's wrong. workplaces, in my experience, are almost universally incompetently run, incompetently managed. That's just a given. And these people see it, and they don't like it, and it frustrates them. Hang out with those people, you'll learn a lot. I guarantee it. Just make sure that what they're saying is genuine. If you listen just a few times and you're like, hey, you know, they're right, then hang out with them. They'll be right again. They've got a voice of reason and they're listening to it and they're frustrated that no one else has that truth meter, as I call it. Many people have a defective truth meter. It's interesting, some people get upset when you are sure of yourself. It actually upsets them. I find that amusing because I've always had a quality that is very sure of itself, the most sure of itself, and that's the 8 quality. I had max 8, just above max 8. There's probably technically a way to have had more, but I had a great deal of the 8 quality, especially when I was younger. I was an 8. I'm always an 8 in the birthday, but I was an 8 under an 8 when I was first 27 years of life. And then I had the 8 in the first name, and I had the 8 in the total. I even initialed in a way that it was an 8. Well, I just know, I have a strong sense of knowing that's stronger than the average. It doesn't mean I'm always right. It just means that, how to describe it? A sense of knowing. I think the way we can understand it is if we apply it in an area that is less threatening. Like, for example, if you are, let's take Gordon Ramsay. This is a very different field. Let's take him in food. You know, Gordon Ramsay comes across as a prick. You know, it's a really not nice guy. But Gordon Ramsay really knows what he's doing. He has a strong sense of knowing. It's interesting when you watch MasterChef with him and those other two guys. They're all like that. They all have a huge sense of knowing of what the contestants are doing. To the point where they no longer record what each person has cooked. They no longer test it in public on camera. They only test the best one for one of the stages of the competition. The first stage, you might say, each week. And they select 3 people and then they test their food. They know that those are the 3 best out of the whole group. They skip the rest. That's kind of astounding. And, you know, the thing is, you don't see anyone on camera going, why don't they test our food? They understand it. I mean, they're disappointed. They want their food to be tested. But you don't get people going, I quit. This show is disgusting. They didn't even test my food. People realize that you can have a sense of knowing about food. You can know who has an interesting range of ingredients and is very good with their flavors. And I think the judges, Gordon and the others, they walk around and they, you know, sometimes they'll ask questions. What are your ingredients? Maybe they'll do a little sample. Can I taste your sauce kind of thing? But they know. They simply know what are the best dishes to taste. Well, the interesting thing really is not about those who have a sense of knowing. What's interesting is why don't some people have that? And the answer is the 2 quality, the quality we've been talking about tonight. The 2 has the least sense of knowing because the 2 lacks confidence the most. And that lack of confidence undermines the 2 like you would not believe. It's probably no exaggeration that if you got rid of only the 2 quality from people's names, and I think there are 4 or 5 qualities that, I'm just working it out, there are 5 qualities that you don't want in the name. But if you only got rid of the 2, just one of those 5 qualities that you don't want in the name, life would probably become immeasurably better. Vastly better. So much better that we couldn't believe it. Because the 2 lacks confidence, the 2 is great at using others, and the 2 is truth challenged. So you lack confidence, you think, yeah, I can't do it myself, I can't do it honestly. You're good at manipulating others. And you're truth challenged. And so that's the makings of a conspiracy. You know, it's interesting how people are shy of the word conspiracy. If you're really thinking, if you're really analyzing life, that word conspiracy or equivalent should be on your mind constantly. Because it is absolutely everywhere, constantly. One of the ways they control us is there are certain words we're not allowed to use. They don't allow us to use them. They freak out if we use the pejorative words to describe various races and creeds and, you know, colors and genders. They freak out if we use those words, right? Well, they freak out if we use the word conspiracy. They absolutely freak out and they label you. You're a conspiracy nut. You're not a conspiracy sandwich, conspiracy lasagna. You're a conspiracy nut. Automatically, you're a nut. And that's really quite hilarious, considering that You know, if you really had to analyze crimes and wrongdoings, I think, honestly, conspiracies, people conniving and cheating and deceiving other people, is the true constant of our times, of life and of people. There's nothing more common than conspiracy. But they've stolen that word. They've repossessed that word. You're not allowed to use it without it being a career ender. It was interesting. I was reading about, if I can remember, I didn't sort of log the whole story, but there was something where, I think it was at a newspaper equivalent, and how they weren't allowed, and I don't know if it was the word conspiracy or it was another word like that, and they weren't allowed to use that word. They weren't allowed to think that thought. This is the reporters, the people that worked at this newspaper. They wouldn't print when people had a conspiracy. They wouldn't go there. Well, what does that tell you? It's shut up and go along with the scam. If you don't like it, you're fired. That's the way life is. Shut up and go along with the scam or you're fired. It's all too common. All too common. And it all comes down to the two quality. Because here's the thing. If you do something honest, if you do something yourself, if you're creative, or if you're hardworking, or if you are patient and do something for 50 years and get really good at it, you're going to succeed. You're going to get your recognition, and you're going to feel good about yourself. All you have to do is work at it, and you will get the best feeling of your life by working at it. But, big problem for the two quality, they don't want to work at it. They will balk. They will find a way. They will come up with excuses. They will whine and moan and all those things. They will try and get others to help them. They will find excuses. They will avoid mentioning that they didn't do it. And all the while, they are suffering. All the while, they are unhappy. The truth, happiness is right in front of them. But they don't take that because it involves work. Or it involves the truth, being honest, and saying, hey, you're ugly, and your mom dresses you funny. The two just won't face the truth. It's anything but the truth for the two quality. And this is in the extreme of the two quality. This is the two when they're confronted by something that they personally can't bear. People have, you know, different amounts of the two. It's in different positions. They have other qualities that work with and against it. But the two wants to avoid. And then they end up avoiding life. They avoid the greatest part of life. They avoid the sense of knowing. When you follow what's right, you get to a sense of knowing. Gordon Ramsay followed what was right with cooking. And by doing that, by following his bliss, by following good cooking, by learning what bad cooking was and calling it bad cooking, Gordon Ramsay has become extremely good and has gained a sense of knowing. And he can live within that knowing. That's the beautiful thing. That's the great life. That's the successful life, is when you live within a state of knowing. Because when you live within knowing, you can be in prison. It doesn't matter. You know. You know, the example is it Galileo or one of those early guys in the Copernicus, whoever it was, and that gets excommunicated from the church, and one of the guys got arrested for like 30 years. Sacrilegious, all that jazz, you know, religion controlling science, isn't that amazing? And, you know, by the way, that hasn't gone away. More of that later. But the point is that the church can do all they want to you. And it's kind of hilarious when you think about how people are influenced by the church rather than by the truth or by common sense or by, to heck with them. Like, all you had to do, let's say you were doing something the church wasn't happy about, all you have to do is leave town. You're like, I'm out of here. I don't like the show. I'm getting up and leaving. I'm going to go to a different country. I'm going to go on the road. I'm going to travel. I'm going to get to a different country. I'm going to change my name. And I'm going to hang around with people that ain't religious. You know? But instead, they try and reason with the church, which is like trying to reason with a 2x4. And then the church goes, yeah, well, we thought about it, and we've decided you need to be put in jail for 30 years. Anyway, assuming you're sufficiently confused that you allow yourself to be put in jail, you still know. You still know the truth. It's like Einstein when they were testing his theory. He had come up with relativity, and they were at the stage of, you know, hadn't been confirmed yet, hadn't been tested and measured and verified. And then they came up with that whole eclipse thing, and there was only so many eclipses a year. They were in different parts of the world. They're not conveniently located. You had to travel, and people traveled, and then they had bad weather. You know, when it's cloudy, you can't measure an eclipse effect, and then they had to wait again, and then there was wars, intervening wars, but eventually it was confirmed. And someone came up to the Einstein sort of thing, and they were like, hey, isn't this exciting? It was confirmed, isn't, you know, are you excited? And Einstein was like, no, of course it's confirmed. I said, in Vienna confirmed it, I would have simply thought he did the experiment wrong, because I knew my theory was right. That was Albert Einstein saying that. He was that sure of his theory. The state of knowing is pretty awesome, and it comes from thinking about something completely, embracing it completely, and filtering out your own weakness. Don't let your weakness into your thinking. This is why we try and do away with bad habits. They affect our thinking. Bad habits are hazardous to our health, even if it isn't drinking, which, of course, is obviously one of the most well-known bad habits. But avoiding the truth is a bad habit. Siding with the person who says nothing versus the person who's irritated, that's a bad habit. There's no reason for it. The person who's irritated has probably analyzed it. They've probably got a lot to offer. Now, you may not want to live with them. You may not want to be around that message perpetually. But there's nothing wrong with being around it long enough to get the message. And go, okay, I see what you're saying there. That community south of us has terrible traffic habits and traffic monitoring. And yeah, they kind of suck. Let's avoid them. Spread the word. Avoid this community. Pass it on. You know, if everyone did that, that community would stop doing what they're doing because they'd have no business. You know, people make up little cards. You have it on a website and you can print it out and the card says, you drop it off whenever you're at a business in this little community and you go, just letting you know, I don't frequent your establishments in this little community because of your unfair and ridiculous traffic monitoring policies. And you just drop it off and it's like, have a nice day. You're just very polite about it, but everyone has the cards and everyone starts dropping them off. That's how good things, bottom up, good movements start. And of course, that's how they co-opt them, right? They print out a label which says, something dumb that would make sense to them that I don't even think that way. I can't even think of an example right now. But they co-opt it. The fluoride movement is, I know some specific people trying to co-opt it, trying to slant it and spin it and turn it. The fluoride movement is one thing. It's a poison. It happens to be a particularly nasty poison that is particularly biologically active. We're done. We're done with that subject. Why would you put that poison in the water? Only a lunatic, only a psychopath would do that. You know, I realized something a day or two ago. Just a nice, simple little thought on fluoride. Fluoride is a weapon of mass destruction. It's a fantastic weapon of mass destruction. Fluoride does nothing good. No one needs it. It etches glass. You know, it's physically destructive. But biologically, it's like swallowing a bomb. It's like swallowing a bomb and then the bomb goes boom inside of you. Supposedly, we have departments that care about homeland security. What a lie. That is the Department of Homeland Lies. Maybe that's what you should do. Whenever you see the word security related to the government, you should just substitute the word lies. You might find it's a pretty accurate replacement. So that was my re-listen of the week was Bill Hicks. There was other things I listened to, but that one will do. I got to move on here. This one's getting really long. I'm partly inspired this week by Joe Rogan, the Joe Rogan Experience, his podcast. This guy has become a serious podcaster, apparently in just 3 years. He's done over 500 of them. That's like one every, 3 days or something like that. That's phenomenal in itself. Another thing is these are long. They average about 2.5 hours long. I guess it's 3 hours raw time. And in some cases it's more edited than others, I suppose. So the final length is a little bit variable, just like mine. I can sympathize. This Joe Rogan is a phenomenal podcaster. Now here I am, pushing somebody else and giving up business, right? Go elsewhere for your podcasts. Do not listen. I just have to hand it to Joe Rogan. One thing is he's a fantastic listener. And he really molds himself really well to the people he interviews. And he always interviews someone. It's interesting, some podcasters are, like myself, I don't interview others. Bill Burr, who's another well-known podcaster, he doesn't typically interview others. And when he does, by the way, I don't care for it. I will actually skip that part of his podcast. Some of us are just better with a pure stream of our own thoughts kind of thing. But Joe Rogan, he gets phenomenal people on his podcast. Now, for this to work, the guy doing the interviewing has to be really aware and clear-headed about themselves. They have to know their own weaknesses, their own biases. And they have to have a head on their shoulders. they have to be a serious intellectual. Once you've got all that, then you can filter that out so that you just get into the other person's headspace. You walk a mile in their moccasins and you bring out what they have to offer. And Joe Rogan is really good at that. I totally salute that guy. He's doing something significant there, there's no doubt. Just in the last couple of days, I listened to three or four of them, and that's an accomplishment in itself. I mean, you know, it's interesting. L.A. has some of the worst traffic in the world, and apparently he lives in a suburb of L.A. And interesting that his podcasts are much longer than normal. They're almost like famously long podcasts. But the traffic is worse than normal there, and people spend more time than normal. Like, apparently just to drive across L.A., I've heard, it can take hours or, you know, all day type thing. Just to drive across from one side to the other. Anyway, so his podcast has evolved for the area where he lives, I think. You got one of his hefty podcasts, well, you're going to listen to the whole thing in 1 or 2 days driving kind of thing. And he does them comes up with them every couple of days, you know, 3 a week. And so literally your drives are full of Joe Rogan, which is just really awesome. Way to go, Joe. Fantastic stuff. Rewatch of the week. Well, I mentioned that Bill Hicks interview, and you know, part of that is you watch the guy. I mean, mostly with Bill Hicks, you're listening. Oh, yeah. A couple things I wanted to talk about. I happened to catch Barcelona playing Apoel, A-P-O-E-L, this past week, just by fluke on the soccer channel. And like, I'm always sort of on the messy watch these days, because soccer is super boring, and I can't watch more than minutes of it. Even the summarized minutes of a game. To me, soccer is about as boring as baseball. You need to boil the whole game down to 5 minutes, and then it's mildly watchable. Anyway, Barcelona was playing this Apoel, and I thought, hey, I'll record this game, and I can fast forward through the boring parts and maybe catch some messy moments, right? Well, there's nothing new to report from the world of soccer. I've already, you know, done the article on it and the video on it. And soccer is just hopelessly flawed in how it's designed. Hopeless. This game, with the best soccer player in the history of soccer, was boring. Messi. He set up the only goal. The players on the Apoel team, they hard-fouled Messi, but they only drew a single yellow card, which is basically almost nothing for a consequence. So I say in my notes, the flawed design of soccer produces flawed games. It would be bizarre if it didn't produce that. Or I say, it would be as bizarre as it is impossible to produce a better result. Someone used to say, someone that I really respect, used to say very often, an evil tree can't produce good fruit. And I think it was a somewhat biblical reference. And by the way, you know, you can't just totally reject the Bible. Or you know, it's unwise to totally reject the Bible. The point is, don't waste your time reading it. But don't totally throw out the baby with the bathwater. There is some truth in the Bible. And there are some sayings that are conditionally worth repeating. And so the point is that when you have a flawed thing, you're not going to produce good stuff. It's like if you have a flawed instrument, like the bagpipes. And what makes the bagpipes flawed? You can't make all the notes. That's it. How are you supposed to make a tune when you can't play all of the notes in the tune? That's the problem with the bagpipes. Yeah, they're screechy, high-pitched things, but they don't have all the notes. Ah, dear. Soccer doesn't have all the notes. Poor Messi. He's just so far beyond anybody else. It's just, there's soccer and then there's Messi. And history is going to look back at this time and go, boy, did we squander Messi. We wasted Messi. You know what it's like? It's like during the World Wars, you know, some of these sports people, they were really good and then the war came along. Or they got drafted, like Muhammad Ali, right? Vietnam War comes along, he gets drafted and he's like, heck with this, I'm going to Canada, and he doesn't want it, and then of course they take away his titles, and then he can't box for a while, right? And he's by no means the only case. You lose him for that period of time. History could have been different if we hadn't lost that person for that period of time. I think there was a famous golfer, I want to say Ben Hogan, but it was one of those famous golfers, and he had a very serious car accident, and he almost died. This guy was super dominant. He was the guy that, you know, win almost all the tournaments. He got injured, almost died. For a few years, he couldn't even play, or, you know, he had a slow comeback. What could have been if that hadn't happened? Well, this is what's happening with soccer. Soccer is a deeply injured game, and the best people are being wasted on the current system. All right, I have more to talk about. I did good in gathering notes this week, but I'm just running out of time here. This is already, like, going to be the longest one ever. Let's go for a quote here. I'll do two, just because I don't want to end on the note of the first one I'm going to do. Bill Hicks, his last words. And they weren't the last words like while he's taking his last breaths, you know, dramatically, you know, on his deathbed type thing. But they were the last thought that he wanted to leave the world with. And he says, "I left in love, in laughter, and in truth. And wherever truth, love, and laughter abide, I am there in spirit." That's really impressive stuff. But it's a little sad, so I'm just going to do one more. I was watching a best of George Carlin on YouTube, and in the middle of it, because George Carlin, there's a lot of truth to that guy, and then, you know, the best of George is the best of insight, if not truth. And in the middle of this thing, they just sort of, they went rogue, this YouTube went rogue, and they were just showing, like, quotes, which were trying to talk about truth sort of thing. And one of them said, "Real eyes, like a person's eyes on their head, real eyes, realize, the word realize, real lies." So real eyes, realize, real lies. When you have real eyes, when you can really see things, then you will realize all the lies. It's cumbersome to repeat that quote, but it's the kind of thing you can print out and just have those five words on a poster on your fridge kind of thing. Just to remind you to realize, to see those real lies, because life is just saturated with them. Anyway, this has been Floyd Maxwell, justthinkit.com, doing a Floydcast number 32 for September 22nd, 2014. Good luck with your life. Take care.